the fungi, they have to be moving carbon in one direction and phosphorus in the other. But exactly how they do that is still completely unknown to scientists. So somehow they are separating these resource streams without any sort of barrier, no physical barrier that breaks it down. So imagine, it's sort of like you're having traffic, but like not having any lanes where you're going one way or the other, but just self-organizing these waves of resources. And so what we're doing is now tracking individual particles that are inside these fungal networks and trying to understand how they're using these flows to move the resources in a way that not only allow them to extract the resources and trade it with the root, but get a fair price in the sense that they are essentially calculating across the entire network where to move the resources.
And they're vast. Individual mycorrhizal fungi form vast networks and extend over huge areas, and they are individual, single individual organisms.
Yes, so they are individual organisms which potentially can cover, maybe even square kilometers in forest. We actually do not know. But so the idea is that, they make these networks, they grow these individual fungi, but it's always like it's a community, it's with many different species, and they simultaneously link different plants, so they create really like physical links between plants below ground, and they really they trade these sugars for these nutrients in the soil, and there was some very interesting research by Toby Kears that really the fungi can really choose which plant they give more nutrients, and that they give more nutrients to the plant from which they get more sugars. And the other way around is also true, that the tree is able to give more sugars to the fungi that give them more nutrients. So it's really like a trade interaction.
My name is Toby Kears. I'm a professor of evolutionary biology at the Free University in Amsterdam. The fungi are actually very good at taking resources from where they're very readily available, and then moving them across the network to places where they're less available and the plant is willing to pay more for them. So where resources are low, they are getting more carbon in return from the plant. And you can imagine, these fungi have been under natural selection for hundreds of millions of years. It's not surprising that they would have evolved strategies that allow them to optimize their trading patterns.
It's really a bit about a poker game, right? So this is what we're trying to understand, is this trade for carbon to phosphorus, and you've got the plant root on one side and the fungal network on the other, and they've been doing this for 450 million, I get shivers thinking, 450 million years. And so this is me in the corner, just trying to watch. And I would argue that a lot of what's been happening is in the dark, right? In these systems, it's totally underground. So it's very, very hard to understand and track these trade strategies.
So I'm opening up a video right now of some of the dynamics that we're seeing inside these networks. What surprised people the most is that this is in real time, right? These are videos that are not sped up. This is actually what's happening below our feet. And so it's a very, very fast dynamic movement. It looks like a living river, but how can a river have so many different dynamics at once, where you can have the river banks flowing in two different directions simultaneously? Nutrient rivers that are just pulsating with carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen, and they're connecting plant roots. These are ecosystem engineers. I think most people would agree now that if we lost the fungi, the soil would not stick together. It would just start washing away. Fungi are the seam that hold ecosystems together. And yet we don't know who is where. And so we've started this project as the first attempt to get a global picture of where these fungi are. In the next 18 months, we're trying to gather about 10,000 samples. And so it's a massive effort to put these fungi on the map, the way that we have maps of global vegetation or ocean currents, right? These are all systems that we have started to map. Even the stars, we have better maps of than global fungi underground. And this is just key. It's just shocking to me that we haven't developed these maps, considering how important they are for our climate, how important they are for plants and therefore for animals, all surviving above ground, and yet to have no idea of how these networks connect ecosystems across the Earth is shocking to me. There's a really growing, a large and growing body of research that's showing just how negative deforestation can be for fungal networks. And sometimes it takes decades for these networks to recover. Fire systems, you know, there's some fungi that are amazing that are able to come right back after a fire system. But these symbiotic mycorrhizal networks are not one of those types of fungi, and they take a very long time to come back. And again, you know, decades can go by, and then still low levels of diversity, low levels of abundance. Agricultural systems, especially conventional agricultural systems, where, you know, there's tillage, there's pesticides, there's fungicides. You know, eventually there's just not much soil life left. I think the latest UN numbers say that 90% of soils will be degraded by 2050, right? 2050. I can picture 2050. That's very soon. And so that's what we have to worry about. Don't leave your soil bare. Right? That's a really, really, really bad thing for fungal networks. You know, advocate for green roofs in cities. A lot of people don't know, but these fungal networks, they spread through spores airily. They're in the air, the spores, right? And so if they can have some kind of corridor of green through cities, this helps them survive. This helps them form healthy networks within the urban environment themselves, is having green spaces. So there's people can talk about underground ecosystems the way that they talk about Amazon forests and coral reefs, right? They can start to appreciate the organisms that live down there. And I think to be able to do that, they need to understand, they need to start being able to visualize what is under our feet. So we founded Spun to start to map, protect, and harness these fungal networks. What we want to do is get citizens and the public and activists involved in this process. People that, you know, are interested in fungal biodiversity and are interested in going out and sampling in their own yards and helping us build a bigger, clearer global picture of these fungal networks. In the next 18 months, we hope to collect about 10,000 samples. We want to develop the first red list, right, for fungi. You know, which ones are we most worried about? And maybe not within the first 18 months, but a big goal of ours is to develop the first fungal conservation easement, right? So that we could have land conserved for something other than plants or animals or the things that you see above ground, but a conservation priority for something you don't see below ground. And I think this is kind of a moment, right? Where we have this chance to overturn our above ground bias. Right? I mean, for decades, we've been focused, centuries, everything is about above ground climate solutions, above ground conservation strategies. All the agendas are about what we see above ground, but they fail to recognize what's happening below ground.
Yeah, this initiative that Toby started, right? The Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. I mean, yeah, we really need to map these networks globally. We really need to try to understand, what these networks look like and how they function ultimately.
Yeah, it's really exploration, you know. And it's essential. Without these fungi, the trees wouldn't be able to grow. And many of our terrestrial ecosystems would simply not exist the way we know them, so.
The real challenge here is actually to get to the roots. So we have to break through the pavement. This guy from the city that's going to help us has brought some tools.
And they're now lifting some of these stones from the pavement. And it's intriguing, like there are people walking here and cars parked, but we are really walking over a living network of tree roots and fungi. There's like so much happening below our feet, even here in the city, you know, that is remarkable, I think.
Underground networks.
Yes, underground networks, yeah.
Special thanks to Bart Brown and the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, for the audio track of Toby Kears's presentation. Learn more about Toby Kears's research, mycorrhizal fungi, and the underground networks they form at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. The destruction caused by extreme storms, droughts, and wildfires can harm the economy. So Allie Lindstrom of the Sierra Club says that to protect the retirement savings of teachers, firefighters, and other public workers, public pension funds need to address the risks of climate change. Lindstrom co-authored a report on how 30 public pension funds in the U.S. are responding to climate change in their voting records and proxy voting guidelines, policies that shape how the fund votes on shareholder issues.
For the average person, shareholder voting might fly under the radar, but it's a really important way for investors to hold corporations accountable to being good community members.
She says the highest scoring funds have guidelines that recognize the risks of climate change to the economy and set expectations for companies to take action. For example, by limiting carbon pollution.
If you are a public pension fund plan participant or beneficiary, you have a right to advocate for the pension fund taking steps to protect your retirement savings from the impacts of climate change.
So she encourages people to speak up at public meetings by email or through their union. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is Hwaenge Shachlech, host of Free Voices on Thursday at 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And on behalf of everyone here at CJSF, I want to thank you. We appreciate you tuning into 90.1 FM on the dial, choosing to spend your time tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM. Shows you value the hard work of our hosts and programmers, and we value your commitment. Thanks for being here.
This is Bird Note. Crows, large, black, noisy. Some people love them. Others aren't so sure. Crows are opportunistic feeders. They can eat just about anything. Snakes, frogs, fish, fruit, seeds, and carrion. They've also learned to peck through our trash cans and visit our landfills. Crows may devour other birds' eggs or steal baby birds from a nest to consume or feed to their own young. Understandably, that puts some people off. They become the bad boys of spring. But crows are resourceful. There's no denying that. A crow can pick a clam off the beach, fly into the air, and drop the clam on a hard surface to break it and expose the animal inside. Crows can even remove the meat from the shell of a crab. Crows have adapted to our modern world. For one thing, they too have a taste for fast food. Next time you're near your local burger joint, check out the dumpster to see if crows have gathered there. You may find a crow free-for-all. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day. And you can get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram, at Bird Note Radio.
This is Bird Note. Dave Mull is an avid birder and a professional skateboarder, or skate-birder, as he likes to say. And he definitely turns some heads.
If I'm skateboarding and then I pull out my binoculars and start birding, some people see that and they're like, just totally taken aback. And they're like, why does he have binoculars? And what the heck is he looking at? Usually people just laugh outright. But then if they're nearby, I'll be like, you got to check this out. And I'll let them take a look through the bins.
That's birder lingo for binoculars.
And they're amazed. They're like, what? How did you know that was there? It's really fun to pique people's interest like that really unexpectedly. And sometimes it's right in the middle of me trying to film a trick. So the people filming, you know, they might get impatient, but they know at this point I'm obsessed with birds as well as skateboarding. So if I see like a couple of hooded orioles behind me when I'm about to go try a trick, I'm going to put my board down and like check out what those orioles are doing.
And the birds really aren't a distraction for Dave. They help him stay in the zone.
In skateboarding, you'll get a lot of distractions while you're trying a trick, say like traffic or passersby. When I'm skating, I actually gain inspiration from my surroundings and try to take what I can from it to actually encourage me. You know, the birds are flitting from one tree to the next like it's nothing. And I try to imagine I can do a little bit of that, you know, even if it's just hopping for a fraction of a second in the air on my skateboard.
For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Hey, it's so awesome that you are here on the other end of the radio. You are why we're here on the dial. A radio station is nothing without its listeners, and that includes you. Thank you for tuning your ears to our broadcast signal on CJSF 90.1 FM.